So I'm going to burn through slides really quickly. So is there anybody in the room who doesn't know what Second Life is at this point? Okay, good. Yeah, no, exactly. And you can ask others. So we're going to just burn through these really quickly. We're going to get to sort of some questions and challenges at the end, and then obviously open it up to a far more interactive version of this. If you have any questions while I'm going, just interrupt me, throw something at me, get my attention, and we'll go. So clear, Second Life isn't a game, though it's often classified similarly to online games. The best fictional analogs are probably the metaverse from Snow Crash, or an even better one would be Vinji's other verse from a short story called True Names. We're relatively big at this point. We're now running on 1,600 CPUs. We're simulating an area of about 100 square kilometers. So in comparison, Boston is about 115 square kilometers. So we're getting close to a real city, which is kind of cool. What makes Second Life different is everything's in it is built online and in real time. And so, in keeping with what everybody focuses on with my bio, I'll use an example of a weapon in the world. This was built by one of our residents. And as opposed to, say, text creation, which would be a blog, or sequential creation, which would be building something in, say, 3D Studio Max and then uploading it to somebody else, the gun in Second Life here was created actually interactively between multiple people in real time online. And so another way to look at that as being different is, say, this is the game Ultima Online. In order to make a, quote, piano in Ultima, people figured out that if you stacked all of this stuff from, like, cloaks and checkerboards and shirts, you ended up with something that kind of looked like a piano. In Second Life, you can make a piano, and every one of those keys plays the correct sound, right? So you could actually be playing that piano in a collaborative 3D environment while people danced on it. You could compose a symphony on it. For all intents and purposes, it is a piano. So just giving a concept of sort of economic scale, we looked at aerial scale of sort of this 100 square kilometers. This is sort of what happened in the trailing 30 days. So we had about 50,000 people use the product. There are 140,000 different items. Now, there were 3.5 million player-to-player transactions, but 140,000 of those were different things. So people had made all of those different things. The value of the internal economy in that time was about $4 million, and about $400,000 of that was actually traded for US dollars. And one of the things that's been most interesting is that the value of each transaction as measured in US dollars has been increasing about 100% a year. So to the people using the world, what they can exchange for is becoming more valuable. So how are we doing that? Well, we have about 60,000 hours of usage a day, and about 20%, 25% of that time is spent creating something, whether it's making your avatar, your appearance look better and different, making something, forming a club, doing anything that we can sort of broadly categorize as creative. So you do the math, right? That's a 2,700-person content development team. So that would cost $270 million a year to pay for, except they're paying us to use the product. So this level of user creation, there's sort of this assertion here, right, that this is driving change in a lot of areas. And you can obviously read the slide faster than I can. But basically, anything you can think of, when you have broad user creation, there's going to be some changes. And what I'm going to do for sort of the next 5 minutes is just run through some examples, probably some you've seen in other venues or heard of. And again, just to continue just ideas of scale here. So 3D creation is traditionally considered a hard problem, right? Content creation in game development, for example, is the majority of your cost of game development. And most of that is going into creating these 3D models. Our residents have made around 100 million 3D objects in Second Life. Building good-looking humans, another traditionally very difficult problem. And our users have made on the order of 10 million different avatars, that look fundamentally different. And of course, programming, often considered hard. There's about 30 million lines of code that our residents have written using the very difficult-to-use scripting language. So this is what happens. You give people tools, and they will go off and use them. Obviously, we saw this with the web and with the net. But there's always been this lingering assertion that, well, gosh, that's text. Text is easy. People can do text. But doing 3D, that's going to be hard. And what we're seeing is that isn't the case at all. Now, of course, you get these wonderful unintended consequences. These were two residents who decided that Second Life as a world needed alien abductions. So they created these alien avatars and made a UFO and started going around and abducting people. And they were really smart about it initially, so they only did it every couple of weeks. And so there's these beautiful posts into our forums of, I've been abducted by aliens, with people responding, no, you're just stressed. You need to rest more. And so You know, and they've also done things like they've held very effective demonstrations when the residents didn't like our taxation structure that we originally had in the system. They held a big demonstration where new users were arriving. They're running around with signs and picketing and lighting themselves on fire, and it was doing a pretty good job of stopping new users from coming into the product. So, guess what? We listened to them, and that's not unique to Second Life. But what is unique to Second Life is their ability to really customize the demonstration to what they want to do. So these are the sort of areas we're looking at. So traditional communication. One of the things we've seen a lot of created in Second Life would be sort of newspaper equivalents. And some of them are very well done. We actually print out the messenger and leave it in our office because they do such a good job on layout. We also see a lot of other forms of communication driven by the fact that you can create. So the upper left was a memorial for the London bombings. And about 25% of Second Life's population at this point is international. So this was very much a collaborative effort between people both in the U.S. and international residents. The lower right was a Katrina that also went into fundraising. And obviously, you know, communication can cross sort of what we would call the magic circle. Games traditionally have this idea that, well, what goes on in the game stays in the game, and what goes on in the real world stays in the real world. Well, Second Life has all sorts of ways for people to break through that magic circle. And so the upper left is our users actually built a Second Life community convention that went on after the State of Play conference. And this was completely done by Second Life residents. They organized about 150-person conference in about 6 weeks. And one of the things they did was they did live streaming video, which, of course, was immediately then streamed back into Second Life so that residents who couldn't come to the community convention could watch it inside Second Life. And the lower left is people using the same tech to do Mystery Science Theater 3000. Right? There's a lot of free bad movies on the net. And so you stream into Second Life and you sit around critiquing them. Cory Doctorow, because he does Creative Commons releases on all of his books, did book signings in Second Life. So here you have a book written in the real world, moved into readers that were coded in Second Life, and then Cory signing a piece of paper, scanning it, uploading it into Second Life, and now you have a signed book in a virtual world. Despite the fact that Second Life isn't a game, there's a great deal of play going on in it. The most interesting in some ways is the bottom left, a game called Tringo that was completely built and designed within Second Life that just was released for within a week is being released for the Game Boy Advanced. So again, here you have something that was built completely inside a synthetic world, tested, played there, and then licensed out to the real world by a resident of Second Life. And no involvement of the Linden Lab in this. And of course, the reason that's possible is that we don't force our residents to give up their intellectual property rights. The things that they create, they maintain ownership of. And so that gives them the opportunity to do something like, I'm going to license my game back into the real world. And let me just skip ahead. A lot of these I wanted to have extra slides so that if they come up in questions, we could go kind of look at them. We see a lot of charitable giving in Second Life. And for example, the American Cancer Society brought the Relay for Life into Second Life. Right, and they had avatars running around who had gone out and gathered money for how far they'd run, and just like they're doing in the real world. And of course, one of the things that they found is that charitable giving in synthetic worlds, people are very free with their virtual currencies. Right, even though you can then trade them on open markets for real dollars and they have value, the people are very comfortable giving of this. Which of course leads us to one of the great false dichotomies of these spaces. People get very concerned about the fact that, oh gosh, people are spending 60 hours a week in these spaces. Isn't that horrible? And one thing to sort of think about, and this will come back when we get to some of the challenges, is there's this assumption that there's play and then there's work and never the twain shall meet. And of course, that's wrong. But even if you don't think it's wrong, I challenge you to look at the value proposition of work of 40 hours a week in McDonald's versus the play of 40 hours a week creating. Obviously, education we've seen a great deal of both within Second Life, where there's all of this amateur-to-amateur education, where residents create or discover something and then go out of their way to educate others within Second Life. We also see it sort of going through the magic circle again. The upper left is a library made of completely amateur fictional works, but it's hosted inside Second Life, so you can go into Second Life and read the works and then get connected back to the real-world website of it. The bottom right's even scarier in some ways. It's a life drawing class. So there's an avatar sitting there. People are sketching in the real world and then uploading scanned images of their sketches into Second Life to then critique each other's life drawing skills. And of course, where this is all going is that there really isn't a magic circle in many ways. The bottom left is Make Magazine, who has copies of their magazine available in Second Life. The upper left is the Second Life Future Salon, which is an organization that hosts monthly get-togethers in Second Life. They bring in all sorts of guests. And in fact, the one on the right is Tom Barnett, who wrote Pentagon's New Map, and which got a lot of play within military circles. And so he came into Second Life, and we built him the UN, and he gave a speech there and talked about his next book, and it was attended and webcast and everything else. We also have a lot of schools using Second Life. These are schools using Second Life to teach university-level classes. We've had experiments with actual therapeutic uses of virtual worlds. This is actually how we met John, that we had first a group of nine disabled people coming in through their facilitator and using Second Life, and then going out onto their blogs and talking about this experience of being able to fly and interact with people in a way where nobody knew that they were disabled. And of course, what they then did is they said, we need to build a place in Second Life to educate other people about our disabilities, right? So much the same way you see that in the blogging world, they were doing all this in 3D. Research, the upper left is the Virtual Hallucination Project that UC Davis did. They built a simulation of schizophrenia hallucinations. After they did patient interviews, they built those hallucinations that their interviews uncovered, and then they took caregivers and doctors and relatives through the experience to say, this is what your patients are going through. What's interesting about it is by using Second Life, within 1 month and spending on the order of hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, they had 800 surveys completed of people who had gone through this and sharing what the experience was like. This is a distributed AI project that a user started, made a standard for AI, and now we have people coming from all over the world to add fish into the pond and play. And of course, so here's where we get to the problems, right? So you have all this amazing stuff going on. It's all amateur-driven. The problem, of course, is nobody really knows what to make of this when you move into, say, academia or government circles, because you start using words like games, and they go, we don't like games, seem bad. You don't want to give money to games. And there's also always a tension between amateur activity and experts, right? Experts have degrees and institutions and centers, and amateurs have their time. And how do you bring those two together in ways that make sense? And so I have sort of one directional option that I want to throw out. I'm not saying this is certainly the only answer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's one that we've been considering. Is it seems like what's needed is some kind of research foundation that's really focused on what both amateurs and experts are doing in these spaces. Because one of the things we've been seeing is that while there is a lot of money going into games research, it's very disconnected right now because, first of all, nobody when they write their grants uses the word game because that will cause their grant to fail. So nobody who's writing these grants can find anybody else's grants. The grant reviewers have no library to go look at because they don't know what to look up when they see using an interactive information technology appliance to research behavioral blah, 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 right? That doesn't sound a lot like a game. And if somebody else doesn't use the same fictional description of this non-game to do it, that they can't find them. One of the things we're seeing within Second Life is we're becoming a de facto clearing center for this. We have about 100 researchers and educators already using Second Life, and that list is growing. And part of the reason it's great that John's here is John's actually our sort of first-line contact on a lot of that, so he can probably answer questions on that if we get any. And so what if you had a research foundation that was able to operate at a peer level to other research foundations and could actually educate other foundations on, look, this is why games are useful, here are some of the things you can do, et cetera, et cetera. Two copies of that slide, sweet. And obviously, lest we be over-constrained when you guys start finding fun things to ask me questions about or to argue about, there are lots of other things that Second Life runs into. Finally, secondlife.com/education is the launching point for all of Second Life's education resources. There's a tremendous blog that the educators themselves have been building there. You need a Second Life account to get to the blog right now. We'll eventually fix that, but right now you need that. But since there's no cost to have an account, that's not a huge impediment. And it's a good starting point for what people have been doing in Second Life. And so I ran a minute or two over, but that's it.